Genesis 27 from verse 41 to the end of chapter 28. Esau held a grudge against Jacob because of the blessing his father had given him. He said to himself, "The days of mourning for my father are near, then I will kill my brother Jacob." When Rebekah was told what her elder son Esau had said, she sent for her younger son Jacob and said to him, "Your brother Esau is planning to avenge himself by killing you. Now then, my son, do what I say. Flee at once to my brother Laban in Haran. Stay with him for a while until your brother's fury subsides. When your brother is no longer angry with you and forgets what you did to him, I'll send word for you to come back from there. Why should I lose both of you in one day?" Then Rebekah said to Isaac, "I'm disgusted with living because of these Hittite women. If Jacob takes a wife from among the women of this land, from Hittite women like these, my life will not be worth living." So Isaac called for Jacob and blessed him. Then he commanded him, "Do not marry a Canaanite woman. Go at once to Paddan Aram, to the house of your mother's father, Bethuel. Take a wife for yourself there from among the daughters of Laban, your mother's brother. May God Almighty bless you and make you fruitful and increase your numbers until you become a community of peoples. May he give you and your descendants the blessing given to Abraham, so that you may take possession of the land where you now reside as a foreigner, the land God gave to Abraham." Then Isaac sent Jacob on his way, and he went to Paddan Aram, to Laban, son of Bethuel, the Aramean, the brother of Rebekah, who was the mother of Jacob and Esau. Now Esau learned that Isaac had blessed Jacob and had sent him to Paddan Aram to take a wife from there, and that when he blessed him, he commanded him, "Do not marry a Canaanite woman," and that Jacob had obeyed his father and mother and had gone to Paddan Aram. Esau then realized how displeasing the Canaanite women were to his father and mother. So he went to Ishmael and married Mahalath, the sister of Nebaioth, and the daughter of Ishmael, son of Abraham, in addition to the wives he already had. Jacob left Beersheba and set out for Haran. When he reached a certain place, he stopped for the night because the sun had set. Taking one of the stones there, he put it under his head and lay down to sleep. He had a dream in which he saw a stairway resting on the earth, with its top reaching to heaven, and the angels of God were ascending and descending on it. There above it stood the Lord, and he said, "I am the Lord, the God of your father Abraham and the God of Isaac. I will give you and your descendants the land on which you are lying. Your descendants will be like the dust of the earth, and you will spread out to the west and to the east, to the north and to the south. All peoples on earth will be blessed through you and your offspring. I am with you and will watch over you wherever you go, and I will bring you back to this land. I will not leave you until I have done what I have promised you." When Jacob awoke from his sleep, he thought, "Surely the Lord is in this place, and I was not aware of it." He was afraid and said, "How awesome is this place! This is none other than the house of God. This is the gate of heaven." Early the next morning, Jacob took the stone he had placed under his head and set it up as a pillar and poured oil on top of it. He called that place Bethel, though the city used to be called Luz. Then Jacob made a vow, saying, "If God will be with me and will watch over me on this journey I am taking, and will give me food to eat and clothes to wear, so that I return safely to my father's household, then the Lord will be my God, and this stone that I have set up as a pillar will be God's house, and of all that you give me, I will give you a tenth." How do you pick up the pieces after a major upset in your life? When something's gone badly wrong, maybe you've been rejected, maybe you've received terrible news, Maybe you're wondering if you can ever trust someone again, or wondering how you'll ever be able to choose well and do right again. How do you make sense of it when things go badly wrong? How do you move on from a major upset in your life? Well, here was a family in crisis. It was deeply divided because of an act of terrible deception. Jacob, the twin son, favored by his mother Rebekah, had deceived his blind father. His mother Rebekah had instigated the whole plan where he was to pretend to be his brother Esau, to dress in Esau's clothing, to put goat skins on his hands and on his neck so that he would feel hairy like his brother Esau. And he deceived his blind father into giving him the blessing. Isaac had wanted to bless Esau, and yet ended up blessing Jacob. And when Isaac realized what had happened, we read he trembled violently. And Esau, when he realized what his brother had done, was full of rage, and he threatens to kill his brother Jacob. And Rebekah is left worried that she's going to lose both sons in one day. Here was a family in crisis. What are they to do? How are they to move on? How are they to make sense of it all? Well, we're going to look at each of the members of this family to see what they did next. And we'll see some bad responses and we'll see some good responses. And hopefully we'll also see how God's response is one of grace and how we can respond to God's grace. So let's start with Esau. And we look at Esau, and really the heading here is simply, Esau carried on doing his own thing. Esau carried on just doing his own thing. Now, if all you had was the story in chapter 27 of Jacob cheating Esau out of his blessing, we would see Esau really as a victim of his mother and brother's deception. But that is not all that we know about Esau. And so we can't regard him simply as the innocent one cheated of his rights. He was cheated, but he wasn't altogether innocent himself. Both his earlier actions and his response to what his brother did show that he is not a man of faith. He had despised his birthright. Remember that time he comes home hungry from being out in the field hunting? And he sees the stew that Jacob is making and asks for some. And Jacob, the cunning one, says, well, I'll give you some if you sell me your birthright. Esau was the oldest. Esau would have received a greater share of the inheritance. And Jacob wants it. And Esau despises his birthright. For a bowl of stew, he sells his birthright. Now you might think, well, maybe he's just not being materialistic. Maybe he doesn't care about money. But it wasn't simply the money. Because with that birthright came the promises that God had made to Abraham. And those promises then were to go through Isaac. And then Esau, being the firstborn, you would expect that he would be the one who inherits the promise of the land, the promise of blessing, the promise that they'd have descendants as numerous as the stars of heaven. And Esau despises all that. For a bowl of stew, he gives up the inheritance of those promises. And now, tricked of his blessing, he doesn't admit his earlier wrong, but instead is just full of revenge. Look at verse 41. Esau held a grudge against Jacob because of the blessing his father had given him. He said to himself, the days of mourning for my father are near, then I will kill my brother Jacob. There's a few instances of sibling rivalry in the Bible. Of course, the first, which was Cain and Abel, did result in murder. And here we have Esau wanting to kill his brother Jacob. Now, wrong as Jacob had been, his crime did not deserve the death penalty. But Esau only thinks of himself how he's been cheated and what he's going to do about it. You see, plotting revenge is the action of a man who does not trust in God as judge. As individuals, we're not to take revenge. Of course, there's a place for the law, and it's another whole area. But as individuals, we're not to take revenge. Vengeance is mine, says the Lord. We're to commit to God as the judge the outcome. When we're wronged, we're not to take personal vengeance. That's not to say we can't have access to the law. That's a different matter. But plotting revenge is the action of a man who does not trust in God as judge. So we see Esau responding badly to this terrible crisis in the family. The other thing he'd done wrong was marrying the Hittite women. Back in chapter 26, verse 34, when Esau was 40 years old, he married Judith, daughter of Beeri the Hittite, and also Basemath, daughter of Elon the Hittite. They were a source of grief to Isaac and Rebekah. Now, firstly, he shouldn't have married two wives. God's pattern given in Genesis, Adam is given one wife, not two. But also, he should not have married Canaanite women. Hittites were Canaanites. Why? Again, because the promise was that God was going to give this land to Abraham and his descendants, and the inhabitants of the land would be displaced because of their grossly sinful behavior. And so for Esau to marry into the Canaanites was an act of defiance against God's promises. And yet he did that. He doesn't even seem to realize how much it grieved his parents. So here in verse 8, in chapter 28, when Esau has heard that his father has told Jacob to go and not to marry a Canaanite, but to go back to Paddan Aram and marry there, we read in verse 8, Esau then realized how displeasing the Canaanite women were to his father Isaac. And it seems that he's gone all these years without realizing the grief that these two wives of his were causing his parents. So what does he do? He doesn't admit that he's done wrong. He tries to make up in his own way. Verse 9. So he went to Ishmael and married Mahalath, the sister of Nebaioth, and daughter of Ishmael, son of Abraham, in addition to the wives he had already. It's not going to solve the problem, but he's doing it things his own way. And this really sums up Esau. He never admits that he's done wrong. He tries to sort things out his own way. That's Esau. He responds badly to the crisis in the family. Let's think now about Rebekah. And we'll make some application from both Esau and Rebekah after we thought about Rebekah. Rebekah, well, the heading here is Rebekah continued her scheming. Rebekah continued her scheming. She was an energetic woman. She was a woman of action. We saw this right at the beginning. When the servant of Abraham was sent to bring Isaac a wife, and he prayed that the first girl that he spoke to would not just give him water, but would offer to give water to all his camels. A huge amount of work. And Rebekah did that. She was asked just for a drink of water for the servant, but she said, I'll water your camels also. She was an energetic person. She used that energy well on that occasion. But once she was married, and as the years went by, it becomes increasingly obvious that Rebekah has her own plans for the family. And she will use her energy and her wit to get people to do what she wants. And so she was the one behind the deception in chapter 27. She planned how Jacob was to deceive his father. And now, instead of acknowledging she had done wrong, she simply resorts to her scheming. How does she respond to the mess? Well, she gets plotting with another plan. And her plan is simple. She thinks it all out, and she calls Jacob and tells Jacob, "Now you need to flee. Your brother Esau is plotting to kill you. You need to flee. Now go to my brother Laban, stay there, and when I think it's okay and safe, I will send you word so you can come back." You see, she's completely wanting to be in control. This is Rebecca, the schemer. And there's just one more thing. She has some clear ideas about who Jacob ought to marry. Now, of course, she knows that it's not really for her as the mother in that culture to instruct her son about whom to marry. Remember how Abraham had taken the initiative for his son Isaac? Abraham was the one who told the servant to make sure that Isaac didn't marry one of the Canaanite women, that Isaac was to marry someone from Haran. So what's Rebecca to do? She, of course, knows that she's hardly Isaac's flavour of the month, having deceived her very own husband. And yet still she's this cunning player. And so she takes an indirect, rather emotional approach. She expresses her deep emotions. And she knows that Isaac is also grieved by the wives of Esau. And so she plays on this and kind of sets Isaac up to do what she wants. So look at verse 46 of chapter 27. "Then Rebekah said to Isaac, 'I'm disgusted with living because of these Hittite women,'" referring to Esau's wives. "'If Jacob takes a wife from among the women of this land, from Hittite women like these, my life will not be worth living.'" In brackets, "Isaac, I want you to make sure that Jacob marries," not here, but, well, maybe Isaac has heard that Rebecca is going to send Jacob up to Paddan Aram, and so it doesn't take too much putting things together for Isaac to know what she wants him to do. So she's the schemer. And at one level, she's successful again. But she only gets part of what she wants. Isaac obligingly tells Jacob not to marry one of the Canaanite women, but to go to his uncle and to marry one of Laban's daughters. And Jacob sets off. Rebecca's plan seems to be working. But what Rebecca really wanted was that the family be all together again. She thinks, just give it a little bit of time, then maybe after a couple of months, I'll be able to call for Jacob to return. But you know, it was 20 years before Jacob returned. And we never read of Rebecca again. So presumably, in the intervening time, Rebecca dies. She does lose her son, Jacob. All her plotting, all her planning and scheming, in the end, did not bring her what she wanted. You see, both Esau and Rebecca, neither of them put their faith in God. They trust themselves to sort it out, and they never admit that they've done wrong. Now I wonder, do you see something for yourself in either Esau or Jake or Rebecca? Are you the person who gets your own way? Because that's what Esau and Rebecca are always trying to do. In Rebecca's words, is your life really not worth living unless you can get things to work out as you want them to? Or rather, are you willing to give way to others? Or when you have to give way to others, do you just feel resentful? Even revengeful, like Esau. You see, in the end, it's a question of who are you going to trust? Are you trusting yourself to get things sorted out, to get your way? Or are you willing to trust God and entrust to him? Esau needed to entrust vengeance to God, not take things into his own hands. Rebekah needed to trust Jacob into God's hands, not to seek to plot and plan all the time. The question is, will we trust God, or are we seeking to plot and plan, doing our own thing? Well, that's Esau and Rebekah, and sadly, they responded to this family crisis in a bad way. They carried on doing what they'd been doing before. Now we're going to think about Isaac and then later Jacob. And we'll see that these two, for all their faults earlier, do actually respond well to the crisis. So firstly, Isaac. The heading here, our third point, Isaac blessed his son Jacob. Isaac blessed his son Jacob. Now Isaac had been shaken to the core by his son's deception. Back in chapter 27, verse 33, Isaac trembled violently and said, "Who was it then that hunted game and brought it to me? I ate it just before you, Esau, came, and I blessed him, and indeed he will be blessed." So Isaac had not willingly blessed his son Jacob. He thought he was blessing Esau. And yet here in chapter 28, Isaac knowingly and willingly gives Jacob the blessing and the promises that God had given to his father Abraham. There's no holding back in what Isaac says to his son Jacob. Firstly, he instructs him about whom to marry. Verse 2, "Go at once to Paddan Aram, to the house of your mother's father Bethuel. Take a wife for yourself there from among the daughters of Laban, your mother's brother." He's not to marry a Canaanite woman. Isaac does well there. And then he gives his blessing. And look at how he puts it. He's not holding back. So verse 3, "May God Almighty bless you and make you fruitful and increase your numbers until you become a community of peoples. May he give you and your descendants the blessing given to Abraham so that you may take possession of the land where you now reside as a foreigner, to the land God gave to Abraham." All those promises that God had made to Abraham, Isaac saying, "Now you take hold of them, Jacob. The blessing is yours." So what's happened? How has Isaac changed so much? You see, this is much more than Isaac simply responding to Rebekah's words of verse 46 in chapter 27, where she says, "My life isn't worth living. If Jacob takes a wife from among the Canaanites, it won't be worth living." Now, Isaac is doing far more than responding to his wife's plea there. Isaac has finally come round to accepting that God's purpose was for Jacob to inherit the promises. And this had been revealed to Rebekah when she was still pregnant. Back in chapter 25, verse 23, when Rebekah went to God saying, "What's going on?" She felt this turmoil within her womb, because there were twins there and they were struggling together. The Lord said to her, chapter 25, verse 23, "Two nations are in your womb, and two peoples from within you will be separated. One people will be stronger than the other, and the elder will serve the younger." And for years, Isaac had never accepted that. He favored Esau, the elder. And yet God had said, "The elder will serve the younger." And now, after this family crisis, eventually Isaac comes round to accepting what God had said. In other words, he's repented of trying to favor Esau. As Hebrews 11 verse 20 says, "By faith Isaac blessed Jacob and Esau in regard to their future." What did he do by faith? He gave the greater blessing to Jacob. And he did it by faith, based on God's words to his wife Rebekah even when she was pregnant. How good it is to read in this story, at last there is someone responding well in the face of deception and hurt. Happy the family where the father is repentant, willing to admit that he'd done wrong, changing and starting to do right. This is a turning point in the story. Isaac doesn't wash his hands of his wayward family, but he changes where he needs to change. His first concern isn't to correct others, but first and foremost, to do right himself. He believes the promises of God and accepts that those promises are going to be fulfilled through Jacob, not Esau. And so he wants his son Jacob to know that he is the heir to the promises of God. And so before Jacob goes, Isaac makes sure that he blesses his son Jacob. If all Jacob had was the blessing given under deception, Jacob would have gone with great doubts in his mind. But now he knows that his father really does bless him, because knowingly, willingly, and without holding anything back, Isaac blesses his son Jacob. How much this must have meant to Jacob. Isaac's words of blessing are spoken in faith, and they encourage Jacob to have faith. And Isaac here is a very good father. He's admitting he'd done wrong, and he changes. And that's a challenge, isn't it? Especially when you're a dad. We don't like to admit that we've done wrong. We don't like to change. But Isaac changes, and he does right. He blessed his son, Jacob. Now, fourthly, let's consider Jacob. The heading here, Jacob received God's grace. Jacob received God's grace. As I said, it must have meant a lot to Jacob, in spite of all that he had done wrong, to have his father willingly, wholeheartedly blessing him. But something greater and even more gracious was about to happen. So he obeys his parents, and the point is made that he obeys them. Verse 7, Jacob obeyed his father and mother. Again, that's a good indication. Something good is going to happen here. He's being obedient. And he sets off for Paddan Aram, which is where his mother had come from. He's leaving the land of promise. He's leaving Canaan. And he's on his own. He would have felt very lonely. He's a fugitive. His brother is out to kill him. And there's nowhere for him to take shelter. It talks about a city called Luz. Of course, Luz was built much later. When Moses writes this, there was a city that had become Luz, and later they gave it the name Bethel. But at this time, this place was deserted. There was no inn for him to book a room. He had to sleep out in the open on his own. But as he slept, God gave him a dream, a famous dream, a dream in which he saw this stairway that went from earth up to heaven. And the angels of God, who often in the Old Testament are depicted as roaming the earth, like in the book of Job. But here they are at this point, they're ascending and descending. And it's a powerful, dramatic portrayal of how God, by his angels, is with Jacob. And then above the stairway, there stands the Lord himself. And then the Lord speaks in his dream to Jacob. I want you to listen carefully to the words of the Lord. Remember what Jacob has done. He has deceived his blind father. He's tricked his brother Esau out of both the blessing and, really out of the birthright as well when he sold that stew. Jacob has not behaved well. He's been a deceptive, cunning character. But when you listen to God's words to him, there's no rebuke, there's no caution, there's only promise upon promise. Listen as I read verses 13 to 15. There above it stood the Lord, and he said, I am the Lord, the God of your father Abraham, the God of Isaac. I will give you and your descendants the land on which you are lying. Your descendants will be like the dust of the earth, and you will spread out to the west and to the east, to the north and to the south. All peoples on earth will be blessed through you and your offspring. I am with you and will watch over you wherever you go, and I will bring you back to this land. I will not leave you until I have done what I have promised you. That is grace. Here was Jacob, deserving nothing, and yet all God gives to him are wonderful promises. He's going to have descendants like the dust of the earth. He's going to have land in every direction. And he's going to be a blessing to the nations, to the world, through his offspring, speaking ultimately, of course, of Jesus Christ. God is going to be with Jacob. God is going to bring Jacob back to this land of promise. What is God like? God is like this. God is a God who gives when people deserve nothing. And when God chooses to bless, he doesn't do so in half measure. There's no cutting back, no trimming down of those promises that he'd made to Abraham and to Isaac. But there's a full repetition. This is the bounteous grace of God. Now I wonder what you make of it. Is this fair? After all that Jacob had done, where's the justice in what God says to him here? What do you make of it? Is this how you see God? And how is Jacob to respond? Well, he wakes up in the night, it's still dark, and we read that he's terrified. When Jacob awoke, verse 16, from his sleep, he thought, surely the Lord is in this place, and I was not aware of it. He was afraid. He's scared, not because of the dark, but because he had had an encounter with God. He's met the living God. This is the first time we read of God speaking to Jacob. He's had an encounter with God. How awesome is this place? This is none other than the house of God. This is the gate of heaven. And Jacob is terrified. Oh, he'd heard about those experiences that his father Abraham had had. He'd heard about God speaking to Isaac in other places like Haran where he was going. But here, God is appearing to him. Now, what Jacob does next is hugely important. You see, he might well have refused God's promises and said, I am completely unworthy and undeserving of anything that God is offering me here. But he doesn't skulk away. Instead, he embraces the promises. He worships God who's appeared to him. How does he do that? He does it in the best way he knows. He copies what his father Abraham and Isaac had done. He makes an altar. The stone that he'd laid his head on, he raises that up as a pillar. Later on, it's described as an altar in later chapters. He pours oil on it. He calls it Bethel, which means the house of God. And he makes a vow to God. Verse 20. Then Jacob made a vow, saying, if God will be with me, and will watch over me on this journey I'm taking, and will give me food to eat and clothes to wear, so that I will return safely to my father's household, then the Lord will be my God, and this stone that I have set up as a pillar will be God's house. And of all that you give me, I will give you a tenth. Now, you may have heard the suggestion that some have made that Jacob here is back to his old tricks of bargaining. Bargaining with God. If God will be with me, then I'll give him a tenth. I don't think that's at all what's happening here. To start with, remember, Jacob is terrified. He is in distress and afraid. He is hardly in a position of strength to bargain with God. So the very context is against that happening. But also, when we read later of how this event is referred to, it's not referred to in any way negatively, but rather as a positive vow that he makes. So just turn on to chapter 31 and verse 13, where God appears to Jacob again, and he says, "I am the God of Bethel, where you anointed a pillar and where you made a vow to me. Now leave this land at once and go back to your native land." So God views this occasion in Bethel very positively and views Jacob's response very positively. "You anointed a pillar, you made a vow to me." And Jacob himself saw it as God's grace here, not as something that Jacob wheedled out of God through bargaining. So chapter 35 and verse 3, and he's speaking to his family here, they're about to return. He says, "Then come, let us go up to Bethel, where I built an altar to God, who answered me in the day of my distress, and who has been with me wherever I have gone." So again, Jacob sees this in a good light. He sees that God had helped him, God had answered his need. So we're not in any sense, I don't think, to see the end of chapter 28 here as Jacob bargaining with God. Rather, he makes a vow to God. He's responding well, he's accepting, he's embracing these gracious promises that God gives. Now let's go back to where we started. How do you respond when there's a major upset in your life? Maybe someone has hurt you, deceived you. Maybe something has gone badly wrong. How do you respond? Well, let me say this. In that situation, what you need most is God's kindness, God's grace. God's grace to be forgiven if you're the one who did wrong. God's grace to forgive others if you're the one who's been hurt. You need God's grace in that crisis. Whether you're the victim or whether you're the guilty one, you don't deserve God's favor, and yet he offers God's favor. God is able to give us his grace so that we can forgive the person who hurt us. I watched a program the other day on BBC. It was about Christian Action Against Poverty. If you get the chance to watch it on iPlayer, it's well worth looking at. And in that, you have the story of someone speaking about how, as a young person, he'd been abused, sexually abused by this guy. And, you know, it had ruined his life. And yet he'd become a Christian. And he was working and was behind the counter, and one day he saw in the queue the very guy who had abused him. What's he going to do? He says, "I felt like jumping over that counter," and by this stage, the guy who'd been abused, you know, he'd taken up wrestling, he was a big strapping guy. He said, "I felt like leaping over the counter and bashing this guy up. I would have lost my job, but at least I would have got my revenge." He says, "No, I didn't do that." He said, "I was trembling. But when the guy came up to me, I dealt with him and I looked him straight in the eye and I said, 'I forgive you.'" So he'd received God's grace. And when we receive God's grace, then we're able to forgive others. And now, here he was, helping others who were in great need, particularly with debt. Whether you are the victim or whether you're the guilty one, you don't deserve God's grace, and yet God offers it. God offered to Jacob, this most slippery, cunning, deceitful of characters, he gives him the greatest promise you can imagine. How do you respond to that? Do you think this is just not fair? Or do you think, yeah, I'm Jacob, and I need those promises too? And let me tell you this, these promises are for any who will accept them. Turn to Romans chapter 4 and verse 16. Here, Paul is writing about these promises that God made to Abraham, promises of grace, of blessing. The promise that he would be heir of the world, verse 13. And then Romans 4, verse 16. Therefore, the promise comes by faith, so that it may be by grace and may be guaranteed to all Abraham's offspring, not only to those who are of the law, but also to those who have the faith of Abraham. He is the father of us all. Not just referring to Jews here. There were Gentile Christians in Rome. This promise that God made of blessing is for any who will believe it. Do you feel in need of God's grace? Do you feel that it would be too big a thing for God to forgive you? Do you feel it would be far too difficult for God ever to accept you, let alone make you his child and make you an heir of the world to inherit eternal life? But that is the God we have. To people who are the least deserving, he offers this great promise. It's not fair. Forgiveness and grace are not about fairness, except that it has been paid for on the cross where Jesus Christ gave his life for us. It is a wonderful message. It's the glory of God to find a way for the most undeserving sinner to receive the greatest blessing. And here's the question. How do you respond to the grace of God? You're going to try and be like Esau and Rebecca and just carry on scheming and doing your own thing and trying to work it out for yourself? It won't work. Or will you be like Isaac, who admitted his wrong and changed? And will you be like Jacob? In spite of all he'd done wrong, he accepts the promises of God. He welcomes the grace of God into his life. Have you done that? Let's pray.